We're here this morning at the North Slope Borough Wildlife Department, and it's another beautiful day here in Barrow. It's bright, sunny again. Don and Tom and Andy and Hio are out enjoying the sunshine. I'm here with Craig George, Harry Brower, and Richard Glenn. I'll let them say good morning and tell them what your jobs are and what you do.
Okay, good morning. This is Craig George. I'm a wildlife biologist here in Barrow with the North Slope Borough Department of Wildlife Management. Next.
Good morning. My name is Harry Brower. I also work for the Department of Wildlife Management. I work as the Subsistence Research Coordinator. I'm also a registered Barrow whaling captain. I've been whaling with my family for many years. I'm a hunter, fisherman. So, good morning to everyone. Thank
you. Morning. My name is Richard Glenn, and I work for our Native Regional Corporation as in the Lands Department. I'm a geologist by training. I studied rocks for many years, and then I studied the ice. Both in school and here at home in our own environment. Also, a whaling crew co-captain and hunter, and I like to be outside. To study the ocean.
All right. Thanks, all of you, for coming this morning. Let me run through a couple of things. Remember, when you ask a question, go ahead and say your name and ask the question. That way we know who we're talking to. And if you're not talking, make sure you use the mute button. Let's start with the Hansons this morning. Can you ask question number one?
My name is Luke. Have you seen any major changes in the occurrence of wildlife in the last decade?
Okay, Luke, this is Craig. My son's name is Luke, too, so interesting coincidence. I'll start off and just say a couple general things, and you guys just jump in. Well, in the last decade, we've seen a continued increase in most of the caribou herds on the slope. We've seen a very nice increase in the bowhead whale population. We just finished our last estimate, and it's right at 10,000. When I began this work, counting whales back in the late 70s and early 80s, we figured there were about 4,000. So that's a nice success story for all involved, whales and the whale hunters. That population looks like it's recovering nicely. We've seen increases in the snow goose population, and they're moving into the area in the last decade. And other species fluctuate right now. There's a lot of lynx on the slope. And actually, snowshoe hares have increased, these sorts of things. But the interesting thing is that there are no exotics. You know, most of the circumpolar species are pretty well fixed. It's very difficult for a temperate species from the temperate zone to move into this region. But anyway, those are some of the changes. I guess the other thing would be the muskox population has increased. The moose took a dive in the early 90s up here, about a 75% reduction across the slope. And we think that was a combination of disease, weather, and predation. And some nutritional things. But anyway, that's a quick snapshot. Anyone else?
Okay. The Albanil family, can you ask question number 20?
Yeah. Can any whale species mix as well? So, hang on.
Yeah, the question was, can any whale species mix, as in dogs or like a horse and a donkey?
There's some evidence of the Balaenoptera family. That's the blue fin, say, minke whale family, humpback family. There's some evidence that some of those occasionally hybridize, like fin whales and say whales, or fin whales and blue whales. but that's the only place I've heard of it. On the slope here, there's no evidence of that. We have bowheads and belugas, and that would be an interesting hybrid, but and gray whales. But anyway, to answer your question, it's just within some of those families, well, like that, the blue whale family, I've read papers that occasionally that happens.
All right. Stone family, can you ask question number 16?
Yes. Can you explain the words Inupiaq, Inuit, and Inupia?
That's good pronunciation.
Take it here. Okay. These are, you know, we have different groups of people identified within our circumpolar north, and the Inupiat are from the, like, around the North Slope and the Northwest Arctic region in Alaska. We call ourselves Inupiat. The Inuit word, it comes from the Canadian and the Greenland people. The Inuit, they call themselves Inuit because they're people of the north in their region, so they call themselves Inuit. And the last one is Inupiat. And you can look at this at in a different method too, that as the numbers of people you're talking to or talking about, Inupiat is one person. Inupiat could be a group of people. So there's different ways of how you want to address that.
Kind of like singular and plural?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Those are all words in our language. Just like we have different ways of talking about people in English, we have different ways of talking about our own, about people in Inupiat language. And like Harry said, those have become, Inupiat have become associated with North Slope people, and Inuit is a Canadian thing. But really, Inuit means people. And Inupiat means real people. Those are the direct translations. And Inupiat is a real person. But Inupiat also is sometimes used like an adjective, like Inupiat language. That's how we describe our language. Some people even say Inupiat language, or how to say it in Inupiat. But they're all kind of misused a little bit because you're using a one language word in another language sentence. But those are all words in the Inupiat Inupiat language.
All right. Thank you. That's a pretty interesting topic there, because for me, I hear those terms all the time. It's
singular word for Inuit is Inuk. That means a person. You might have seen that before, too. Inuk. So there's Inuk is a person, and Inuit is people. Inupiat is a real person. Inupiat is real people.
Okay.
I've got one thing I've got
to say. Okay, Craig has thing to say here.
The question about the whale species, that family is the Balaenopteridae, just so you know.
All right.
Yeah.
Thank you. The Hansen family, can you ask question number 2?
All right, this is Tiana. How do the Inuit get seals out of their seal holes?
Oh, there's this hairy... There's different methods. It depends on what you're doing, or if you're out hunting, or if you're out just traversing out in the ice and you spook the seals in their lairs. You know, it depends on what you're doing. If you're out looking for seals, there's different methods of finding the seals in their holes and underneath the snow. You could use a dog. You know, they leave a scent. They take dogs out, hunting dogs out to pick up the scent from the seal, and then we identify and locate the seal hole under the ice. That's one method. Another would be just traversing on the snow, and eventually, or the ice and snow mixture there, the hole finally comes and penetrates through the surface, and you're able to spot them on top of the ice or on top of the snow sitting next to the hole.
Kuvrak.
And then, Craig was just adding on the word Kuvrak, and setting nets under the ice to capture the seal would be another method.
That was extremely effective, your dad said.
Yes.
And it's not practiced much now. But
you might have seen pictures. A lot of people see pictures of the Eskimos bent over halfway at the waist, just staring at a seal hole, waiting for it to breathe. And when they see a little piece of fur or something move, then they throw a harpoon down in a snow-covered or a hole that's got a snow lid on it. That's Canadian way of hunting seals. It's not practiced around here, but the northern, far northern people in Canada still hunt the seals that way. And like Harry and Craig just mentioned, our old-timers used to set nets in the water around the seal's breathing hole, and that would catch a seal as he came up to breathe. And some of us just go to areas of open water. We know the seals are breathing in holes all around us, but they occasionally go to the open water areas to swim around and eat food or whatever. And so they'll catch seals there in those open water areas in and around the ice.
Right. All right. Thank you. Albanil family, can you ask question number 21?
Yeah. Have you ever had a dangerous situation on the ice?
Too many to count.
Yes, we do have dangerous situations out on the ice. There's people having accidents out on the ice or just getting hurt trying to travel or traverse over the ice out in the ocean. It's not a flat ground. It's some of it's pretty rumbled up, you know, from pressure ridges, and we're breaking trails through that. And it's snow covered, and then you could fall in the cracks with just walking on the top of it, thinking it's a surface to walk on, and then you all of a sudden fall through the snow and injured just walking on the ice. That's one method of being in a dangerous situation if you're out alone. Another method would be ice calving, big pans of ice floating off as you're while you're hunting out there. And you know, it could be caused by anything, tight surge or just the calving, arch pans, that could cause it to float away.
That was one of the ways that a lot of people died in the old days, right?
Yes, because they would be caught in between several pans and they would not have means to get back and forth across the ice that's breaking up. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Some people drifted far away. They just leave Barrow to go seal hunting, and they end up as far away as Wrangell Island. I mean, they can drift hundreds of miles as long as the ice that they're drifting on stays together. It's always dangerous out there. There's 10 different ways that you could either be hurt or killed or cut apart from shore. And you have to be watchful all the time of current, wind direction, thickness of the ice,
Nanooks.
And then, yeah, and there's bears out there that will stop you if you're not careful.
Sounds like a exciting place to be. The Stone family, can you ask question number 17?
Yes. What are some of the most important traditions in Barrow?
Barry again, we just keep looking at each other. Anyway, some of the important traditions that we're trying to keep is keeping the language, speaking in Inupiat. We're trying to practice, bring that back up in through the school educational process.
Speak some Inupiat.
Inupiat rala taruma somewhere in Kungitsikupsi.
Yes.
I'm just saying that I know how to speak in my dialect, and I could translate if you don't understand. It's just what I said.
All right.
Anyway, there's other traditions that we try to keep hunting. There's a lot of different samples that we could, you know, present as in terms of traditional methods or means of hunting using tools and stuff like that. We try to keep our festivities from our successful spring hunts that would entail successful whaling season, and then returning, sharing the resource would be blanket toss. Maybe Richard or Craig could add on some more. I don't want to take up all the space there.
We like, Inupiat people pride themselves, I think, in knowledge of their environment. And that's one of the strongest traditions we have. And we think that our language is one of the most efficient languages in describing the Arctic environment. So talking about how to navigate in a blizzard, or how to tell which way is north when you don't have a compass, what kind of foods can you live on if you're cut away from a town or something, how do you hunt, How do you stay alive? How do you stay warm in a cold place? How do you interpret the ocean? How do you interpret the weather? Mm. All of this is done in the context of our language. And then there's traditional sewing and skills like that, fur clothing. You know, the Inupiaq-style parka is probably the best designed jacket ever made for keeping warm. And there's nothing you can buy in the store that keeps you warmer than our traditional clothing.
Yeah.
And so, and we have dancing, songs, stories, and legends, and celebrations.
You know, I was just going to say, as an outsider, one of the things that I didn't grow up in Barrow, but one of the things that I found most interesting is the sharing network. That the way food is shared up here is amazingly selfless, and it's really one of those things you have to sort of see to understand. But when a captain catches a whale, he doesn't get any more than anyone else. It's all divided up and shared with the community, and that's something that I think Western society can learn from about sharing in the Inuit culture.
All right. Stone family, can you ask question number 18?
Yes. Are any of you fluent in Inupiaq?
I mean,
and this is Patrick, and I have no idea what they all said, so I hope they translate for us.
It's, the answer is yes. There's several of us that are fluent in speaking Inupiaq, because we grew up with our parents speaking to us in Inupiaq, and we had to learn to reply and, you know, get into conversations with them, or learning little items as toys, or as children we grew up, they named things for us, and that's how we get started in learning our language. Just identifying little things, or sharing food amongst each other. You know, we name them and share, and just making laughing gestures and that sort of stuff in learning the language. So that's part of it.
But these days it takes work for raising children now, because we're competing with MTV and the Cartoon Network and school and high school and all these other, you know, there's English in our society, so a person, a child even, has to make a decision to become fluent, and a commitment. And it's a lifelong learning process. I think we're all always learning to be better Inupiaq speakers.
Mm.
All right. Hansen family, can you ask question number 3?
Okay, this is Felicia. I've heard that the Inuit have something like 27 different names for ice. Can you explain that?
I can take a start at it. This is Richard.
Iceman.
You've probably heard also that the Inupiaq people or Inuit people have 50-something terms for snow. And if you think about ice or snow, you can think about different ways to describe each of those things in English. And it usually says things like rotting ice, floating ice, ice pack, pressure ridge. And you see, I'm describing different types of ice in English. Sometimes it takes more than one word, like pressure ridge or rotting ice. But in Inupiaq, we have one word for each of those things. We don't have to say ice pack. We can say sadzi. And we don't have to say land fast ice. We can say tubak. And we don't have to say freshwater multi-year ice, we can say pekaluyak. So it's similar to English. We both are describing the same thing, but we say it just with one word because it's in our environment. And in the same way, we have words for snow, snowpack, sugar snow, drifting snow, falling snow, snow that's covering something. All of those are done with one word, too. So your question, do we have something like 27 words for ice? We've got more than that.
Yeah, a lot more.
But it's, you know, they're describing features, and it's not so different from English, except that we do it all with one word. The base word for ice is siku, S-I-K-U. And a lot of our words start with that for a root word.
My favorite, sikuliak.
And sikuliak is that you can hear siku, that sound in there. Sikuliak means thin ice or young ice, new ice. We work a lot with that bass word, but there's words that don't even have that chico sound in it that refer to ice. The kaluyak is one, kinu, slush ice is another one. So, and then a lot of our words describe the ice features, not just ice itself, but the feature it makes. A shear ridge, a pressure ridge, places where the ice is crumbled together or sliding by itself. So that's how our words work.
All right, thank you. The Albanil family, can you ask question number 23?
Yeah, I'm Willie. Do animals seem to know that what places are safest, like a mama bear to build her den?
This area, I'd say yes. They have their different understandings of what conditions are out there. Especially when you're talking about denning bears or female bears going into den to have their young ones, they know to use what type of ice would be, you know, preferred for them to make their den in. So they do have some understanding of different conditions. So we have our observations, and we're out hunting for other resources. We look at them and observe all the bears in different doing different things, so I do believe they do know the different ice conditions.
Yeah, another good example of that is along the coast, there's ravines in certain areas, like going southwest from Barrow and over in the Arctic Wildlife Refuge and places like that where there's steep cuts and big drifts form, and the female polar bears know about those, and they dig in and dig their dens in those, so that kind of rough terrain is real important to polar bears. Are we still on?
I think so. Can you guys all hear us still?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
One more question, addition to that answer. This is Richard again. Harry talked about what the animals know, and that's related to an earlier question about hunting seals when there's a breathing hole underneath, in the ice, underneath the snow. You can't even see it. We learned to hunt seals in their invisible places like that by watching polar bears. The polar bears showed us how to hunt seals. They can smell where those breathing holes are. And once you figure out where they are, then you can learn to locate them yourself, even though you don't have the polar bear's nose. So the animals have so many senses at their disposal. Their nose is real good. They could probably smell water, for example. So they can tell ice thickness by smelling water. Animals.
All right. The Stone family, can you ask number 19?
Yes. Have you ever gone swimming in the ocean during the summer?
Only the Titanic.
Yeah, only it.
This is Harry. Yes, we grew up along the, you know, along the coast here, and there's different times of the year the ice. We grew up playing on the ice and learning, you know, what pieces of ice pans we could float on and making, playing games out on the ice. So we do fall in occasionally where people running on the same path hit each other and fall into the oceans and have to go swim ashore. Yes, we've gone. There's this, what Craig was talking about, and I only had him respond to that as they're joining the polar bear club.
Right. Yeah, there's a polar bear club in Barrow, and it's mostly tourists. You don't see too many local people going out there, but I try and go in every year. This is Craig. And EMOC, as they say, go underwater. That's falling in. I try to jump in.
I went hunting one time in a river, and my friend didn't tie his boat to the edge of the river, and it blew across to the other side, and I had to swim across that cold water to get his boat, and I didn't like it that much. It was really cold water.
It's really, really cold.
All right. The Hansen family, can you ask question number 4?
Sure. This is Luke.
Huna's here.
Good morning, Huna. How do the Inuit hunt whales from pack ice?
His question was, how do the Inuit hunt whales from pack ice?
Well, you have to be monitoring ice throughout the season. Our climates have changed over the years, and our ice conditions are changing along with that. And we need to monitor the ice conditions as to the shore fast ice, what ice conditions are safe, and we do hunt for whales from the pack ice, shore fast. The pack ice is moving out further north of us, but we're on the shore fast ice, so there's a little bit different. Although we do go into the pack ice.
Okay.
From the shore fast ice.
There's an edge of ice against the shoreline. It's kind of glued to the shore, and we make our trails over that. Sometimes it's rubbly. It looks like mountains everywhere, and other places it's flat. And what we look for is a flat place on the edge of that shore fast ice, and the pack ice sits offshore from us a little ways. There's a hallway of water in springtime that the animals migrate through. And so we wait on the edge of our shore fast ice and wait for the animals. And the pack, like Harry said, is always moving. Sometimes it closes up against the shore fast ice and it glues against it and shears and rubbles and makes our shore fast ice even thicker and more piled up. So how do you hunt animals from the ice? Well, in springtime we go to that edge where the hallway of water is, the open lead it's called. Wait for the animals to migrate through. And in addition to watching how the ice has been behaving all year, we have our elders with years and years of experience who've been watching the ice through their lifetime. And so we have to keep track of what's happening out there and also keep talking to the people around us who know more, who've seen changes, so that we can stay smart and stay knowledgeable about the environment.
All right. Huna, do you have questions this morning?
Yes.
Okay. Why don't you ask question number 5?
How do you study whales?
Okay. Well, I'm a biologist. There's an Inupiaq way of studying whales, and there's, I guess, the scientific way, and they're similar in many ways, but there's some differences. The main difference, I guess, with scientists is that we methodically record everything, and then we look at data that we've recorded, like swim speeds of whales, for instance. You can track whales with a surveying tool like we do, and then you can do the math and then estimate the speeds later. Anyway, generally, to answer your question, there's a number of ways to study whales. You can study them visually from boats, airplanes, the ice edge like we do most of the time, or you can study them acoustically, and that's a growing field where you put microphones under the water and you listen to their calls. And most whales really live in an acoustic world. Sound is much more important than vision to many whales, especially the baleen whales, and a lot of the toothed whales. I shouldn't say that. To all whales, sound is extremely important. And you can use their calls to locate them and to study them, the call behavior, and try and figure out what in fact they're using their calls for, what purposes, like hunting, for instance.
The only difference between Inupiaq whalers and scientists here who study the whales is the scientists are carrying little yellow books.
Yeah.
The little yellow books are the field notebooks that biologists write all their data down in.
And really the scientists have learned more from the native whalers and the hunters than we've taught them. But anyway, it's a nice exchange.
All right. Albanil family, can you ask question number 29?
Yeah. Does the ice have a smell?
Wow.
Yeah, the ice is like wood. It has a lot of smell. It depends on what kind of ice it is. You can sometimes smell the water, ice, the salt. In late springtime, you can smell algae on the ice. Sometimes even snow has a smell, and so this fresh water ice Maybe it's the lack of smell is what you notice. Just like you notice fresh air, you can smell the absence of salt, I guess, on water that's kind of fresh. I think you can. So it's like wood or soil or anything else has many different kinds of smell. So does ice.
Yes, Jerry, I agree with Richard that there's a smell in the ice from being on land and being on shore for a long time and then going out into the ocean and just staying out in the ocean.
Thank you.
Being on land and being out in the ocean.
Yeah. Great question. One family, can you ask question number 6?
Yes, this is Claren. How far out on the pack ice have you been?
This area, I've been at different lengths of distance, a couple miles offshore for hunting, and then I've been out where I've been taken out like 50, 60 miles out because of the ice shearing off and floating away with the ice.
Wow.
And at those distances that, get to be, if you don't. Well, this was before we had our search and rescue, the North Slope Border search and rescue that we depend on so heavily nowadays. If it wasn't for them, we'd have a lot of people that are even further than those, those distances. So
a lot of
50,
people.
60 miles is a long ways out when you don't have a helicopter or any other means of transporting you to safer ice conditions.
Yeah.
I've been I got to go visit an icebreaker. I helped a search and rescue plane go out there, and that was around 370 miles north of here, way out in the pack in Falkland. Did you go visit the ice islands too, or any of those gnarled days? And then like Harry, offshore, we can be anywhere from 2 miles to 15 miles in some sometimes it's not straight out, but it's kind of at an angle, almost at an angle to the shoreline. So anywhere from 2 to 10 miles, usually we're offshore when we're whaling. And then, of course, when this late spring turns to summer, the ice breaks up and kind of floats away. Then we go all over in our boats, even further offshore.
Yeah, the pack ice is there in summer, too. Don't forget that. And this is Craig. I've been out boating and gone on the pack ice and walked around in summer 10 or 20 miles offshore. So it's not just the, fall, winter, spring that we have pack ice.
Okay, Huna, can you ask question number 13?
Sure. What kind of education do you need to become a wildlife biologist?
You need a couple kinds of education. You need the formal education, which is, the basic biology curriculum, and that includes a lot of math, physics and all that. More and more wildlife biology is becoming quantitative science. That means a science that uses statistics and numbers and mathematics to measure things. But the other kind of education you need is to be open-minded and listen, especially to local people, regardless of where you are, and have those kinds of skills of being able to listen to people.
All right. This is Patrick. Craig, do you have to have a master's degree or a bachelor's degree or a PhD to do wildlife biology?
Well, it depends on what you want to do. If you want to be a technician, it's probably best to have a Bachelor of Science degree, a college degree. If you want to run a project, it's best to have a master's or a PhD. I think, in many cases, you can do technician work with the high school diploma, too. But most of the people running big projects now have PhDs, but you can do a lot with just a regular BS degree in biology.
This is Patrick again. Richard, What kind of degree did you have to be a geologist?
I thought that if I went to college for 4 years and got a bachelor's degree in geology, that I would be a geologist. And I came home and was ready to come and work for my people, and the first thing they told me was to turn right around and go back to school. And I learned then that after 4 years studying engineering, you're an engineer. After 4 years or 5 years studying education, you're a teacher. After a few years studying plumbing, you become a plumber. But after 4 years studying geology, you can dig ditches, and that's about all. So I went back to school for 6 more years, and I studied. I got a master's degree, and got into this PhD study. But to be a professional geologist, you have to have a master's degree.
The Hansen family, can you ask question number 10?
All right, this is Tiana. Many experts have observed evidence of shrinking ice and changes in the Arctic environment. Have you observed any evidence of climate change?
We sure have. I'll be brief. This is Craig. Everyone here has seen evidence of this. In the little over 20 years I've been in Barrow, I've seen the winters get warmer, seen the ice tend to be thinner, I guess, and retreat much further in summer. In 1998, you could take a boat and go 400 or 500 miles north of Barrow, when usually you can only go about 20 miles. And not hit ice. So those are some of the changes I've seen. Go ahead, somebody.
I think this is Harry. The changes we've seen in the ice conditions is it seemed to be thinning from the time when I was growing up. We had multi-year ice basically year-round near Barrow and floating ice pack. And in recent times, more like these last few years, the ice has been receding like 200 miles offshore, and it's not so visible, readily visible, like what it used to be when I was a young man or a young boy growing up. It's and the ice thickness has changed even today. That what we're having to be faced with today is that the ice is, the shore fast ice is coming up right up to the beach.
Yeah,
it's floating away. It's not ridging as much as it used to, and getting the bottom pounded ridges out there anymore. It seems to be lighter ice conditions than the polar ice pack is further offshore.
Yeah. This is Patrick. Some of the people that we've talked to earlier this week have talked about two major events of ice breaking off in the winter. And one was 4 or 5 years ago, and all the whale hunters got stranded out. And then one was this spring. Is there any recollection of that happening ever in the last 100 years, or what do the elders know about that?
There's been some, you know, events where the ice sheared up due to different events that occurred. You know, ice and wind currents, ocean currents moving. Those are the different events that caused that.
People now in their 40s and 50s remember a time like, what year was that we all floated away?
97 was the big one. Yeah.
There was a time like that. It happened before in the 50s when people floated away. So it has happened before, but it is getting warmer. And our elders tell us that it was a lot colder even when they were young. If you talk to our 70- and 80-year-old people, the winters were colder for them than they are now. The grass was shorter, didn't grow as long. And scientists are saying the same thing with much of their data. The Arctic Ocean is covered by ice, and if you go to the North Pole, there's always ice around. But the thickness of that ice is changing with time. There's not as much of this what we call multi-year ice, which is very thick ice. And underneath our feet, too, is permafrost. For about 1,000 feet, the ground is frozen. It melts a little bit at the top in summertime, but underneath that, it's frozen. That means that's because it's usually cold here. I mean, more often it's cold than it's warm. More often it's below freezing than it is above freezing. But that permafrost is getting thinner. We've lost some of our permafrost at the very top because over the last 100 years, according to the geophysicists, it's been getting warmer. It's because we're burning coal, maybe, or maybe just because the Earth has natural cycles in temperature, and we're changing for that reason.
Or both.
Yeah, or both. But regardless of the reason, it is getting warmer. There are cycles in climate, there are cycles in temperature change, but there also might be a one-way shift toward warmer temperatures. I hope that we start to see cooler temperatures again and that we come up on the backside of a cycle and see more ice. It's comforting to look out over the ocean in summertime and see that pack ice on the horizon. It means that there's food nearby, there's animals, clean, clear water. And also it means that the water won't get too rough
right. In
fall time. And the waves, the ice protects us from real big waves because it dampens the wind. The wind can't work on water if it's covered by ice. What did you write?
Can everybody still hear us?
Yeah.
Okay.
Somebody played a song on their telephone.
I guess if they can't hear us, they wouldn't answer.
Okay. Can the Albanil family ask question number 28?
Yeah.
Yes, I'm Jesse. Does the reflected bright light seem to bother any animal's eyes as it can bother people?
Oh, no. That's a great question. And, you know, a student asked us that a number of years ago. And we really weren't able to answer it very effectively. And I apologize for not doing some research. But, you know, you wonder how an animal like a polar bear can live on the pack ice without sunglasses. If you go out there in late spring, if you go out in May without sunglasses for a whole day, your eyes are going to feel like sandpaper. You could damage them permanently. It's incredibly bright. Here's a polar bear lives 30 years on the ice without. They have very dark eyes. That's one thing. You usually notice that that's an adaptation perhaps to bright light, a dark iris. But oddly enough, I'm pretty sure these guys were saying that polar bears' eyes shine in the dark, and that means they have that tapetum, that little mirror behind the retina, like an animal like a dog or cat that has a low light adapted eye. And that serves to increase the amount of light that hits the retina. So you'd think that they would lose that, but they don't. So obviously they've got an eye that somehow can absorb those damaging rays and function properly. But if you give me your name, I will try and figure that out and email you.
I can find it out from Craig and put it on the website for everyone to know,
right.
Which
that's
might be the best
all
way.
All of our outside animals must share this trait. I mean, the fox,
yeah.
The caribou, every animal that lives here in springtime on the surface must be able to somehow avoid snow blindness. Harry was mentioning that sometimes... Well, the polar bear smells better than it sees anyway, so sometimes it can move around with his eyes closed and still get around just fine because it navigates by nose. So that
cool.
Might be another adaptation.
I was going to add, not just in terms of bright light, we have snow machines or vehicles that have headlights or that project the light out. During the hunting seasons, even in the spring hunt, we try to keep our lights turned off because they're shooting a beam of light out into the water or the surface that you're traversing on, and that tends to spook the animal, and the animal tends to move away from that light.
Mm-hmm.
They don't go directly towards that light. They move away from the light. That's what I was trying to get at. It's just another thought
in
terms of bright light.
Yeah, okay. Stone family, can you ask question number 12?
Yes. This is Clarence. How many caribou inhabit the area around Barrow?
Hmm. This is Craig. I'll give you the kind of the scientific perspective. It depends on what you call the area around Barrow, whether you're talking about a 5, 10, 50, or 100-mile radius. But we have a big herd to the southwest that numbers about 450,000 animals, the western Arctic herd. We have a smaller herd to the southeast that calves usually about 75 miles southeast of us, and that's got about 30,000. And within, you know, 10 miles of town, it really varies. Most of the time, there aren't many, but occasionally, like this fall and winter, we had quite a few, probably 1,000 or more, or sometimes more than 1,000, but it really fluctuates.
And Greg, there's different herds that we deal with within the Barrow area and hunt from different herds at different times of the year. So they're not sitting still. I was trying to figure out what word to use, but they're not sitting still.
Highly migratory.
Their movements are throughout the year and at different seasons. You know, so they do come close to the community for a short period of time. And move back out and then wander around on the North Slope or wherever they feel like going and then come back around to other communities too.
The caribou survival strategy is moving. They're constantly in motion, and that's the way they acquire the resources they need. They move over huge areas, and it's real important that their movements aren't restricted.
All right. Huna, can you ask question number 24?
What animal is the most plentiful?
Mosquito.
In the Barrow area? Do you mean? Or on the planet?
In the Barrow area.
No,
in the Barrow area. Well, the smallest animals are the most plentiful. So bacteria are probably the... And then mosquitoes. And then when you get up to mammals... Avingox, the most abundant animal, mammal around here is probably lemmings. And then when you get up to big mammals, then the most abundant would be caribou. And when you get to really big animals, the most abundant would be, there's more belugas than bowheads, but then bowheads and belugas and that sort of thing. Does that help? Seals. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. Seals are very abundant.
This is Patrick. How abundant are birds up here in the summer?
There's a different variety of migratory birds that do come around and start nesting within the Barrow area. Some do stay here, and some migrate further east.
Okay.
So they're very abundant, and we do hunt a lot of the migratory birds.
Yeah.
Ducks and geese.
All right.
You can see my bias.
Yeah.
I didn't mention birds. Yeah, there's a lot of birds around.
Okay. I think I'm going to wrap things up here. Does the Hansen family have any other questions?
No.
Probably not.
No? Okay, what about the Albanil family?
Has a whale ever attacked someone?
Hmm.
Yes. You know, not in its natural state, you know, just swimming by, it doesn't really attack anybody. Although if you provoke it, it will. If it'll try to protect itself. Just being a whaler and having been out just paddling my boat, I've been surrounded by whales. I mean, a group of whales. We're going after one whale. But then there's a group of them that came up from behind us and surrounded us.
Oh, wow.
Keep us from reaching that one we were trying to get at.
Wow.
So it stopped our boat from going in motion. You know?
Oh, wow.
I think they were trying to protect that small one. And that if there was, you know, their tail slapping right next to the boat. The whale's tail was slapping the water. That, you know, that's a good indication. It means business to stay away from that group of whales. So we didn't, there was no movement in the boat. Our boat is only 21 foot long, and the whale is 50, foot.
Wow.
And there's no comparison as to what the whale could do to that boat.
Yeah.
And there's been attacks on whaling boats from whales that were struck. That were not, you know, paralyzed or instantly killed, but they turn around and I've seen this whale open its mouth and just like taking a bite.
It was
at the whole boat. I mean, it sunk the boat.
Wow.
Mm. I think nobody was injured or lost in that incident, but we've had incidents where whales turned the boat over and taking people under with them.
Yeah.
Wow. Great question. What about any others from the Stone family?
One more question. Killer whales. Every now and then we see killer whales around here, and we have a legend or tradition and custom. We don't mess with killer whales. And our elders tell us that a killer whale will remember you if you try to do anything to provoke it or somehow hurt it or make fun of it. The killer whale will remember you, even if you're in a different boat or if you're somewhere else and not, you know, where he first saw you. The killer whale has a memory, and he'll even chase you up onto a piece of ice, maybe like you've seen those killer whales do at Marine World or Sea World or something. A killer whale will go after you if you mess with it. So
yes, we've had people killed in our area here from killer whales.
Wow.
Yep. Wow.
That day had, this area again, I'm sorry. Yes, there's been incidents where a couple of people were killed by killer whales that had shot at the killer whale, you know, and injured it before, and it remembered that it were traversing back and forth in a boat, and the killer whale came around and killed both of them. Two guys, they were never found.
All right.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Any last questions from the Stone family?
No.
What about Huna?
No.
Okay. We'll wrap this up here today. Thank you all for coming and
thank you guys.
Thank you.
All your insights.
Thanks.
Thank you.
What?